How many innocent people are in American prisons? It's impossible to quantify, but the number is almost certainly higher than it should be. Because even when strong evidence of innocence emerges, once you're convicted of a crime, it can be almost impossible to get exonerated, thanks to the way the American justice system is structured. Daniel Medwed, a professor at Northeastern University School of Law, tackles this problem in the new book, Barred: Why the Innocent Can't Get Out of Prison. Here's Daniel to share some of his key insights.
Hi, my name is Daniel Medwed, a professor of law at Northeastern University in Boston and author of the book Barred. I will provide a brief overview of the book and then five insights or big ideas that I hope you will find intriguing. Bobby Fennell had spent 16 years behind bars for a murder he didn't commit. We were scheduled to meet for the first time in the summer of 2001. I had some bad news, news that I felt morally obligated to deliver in person. We wouldn't be able to prove his innocence in court. Fennell's 1985 murder conviction stemmed from the shooting of a man named John Williams outside a building in Manhattan where people purchased and used cocaine. Bobby provided security for the drug operation, which made him a prime suspect. He maintained his innocence from the get-go, insisting he was with his girlfriend at the time of the murder. The prosecution case relied on the credibility of a single eyewitness, a man with a drug addiction and a lengthy rap sheet. The witness claimed that Williams got into a fight at the drug den, which prompted Bobby and another sentry, Joe Perry, to drag Williams into the street and take turns shooting at him. That was all the government had, a shaky eyewitness recounting how two enforcers had gunned down a rowdy customer outside the house. Undeterred by the minimal evidence at its disposal, the government filed murder charges against Bobby Fennell and Joe Perry and prosecuted them together in a joint trial. The government lawyer entrusted with litigating the case, an assistant district attorney, asked the eyewitness a series of questions that elicited testimony implicating Fennell and Perry. But the threads holding the story together unraveled on cross-examination. The witness admitted he'd received a sweetheart deal on his own drug charges in exchange for testifying. Also, his responses at trial differed from his prior statements. The jury nevertheless bought his story, guilty. Then an odd thing happened. Right after the verdict, Joe Perry and his attorney met with Bobby Fennell's lawyer. Perry said he'd acted alone in the murder. The key question, of course, why now? Why hadn't Perry come forward before trial to help Fennell? The explanation turned out to be quite simple. Perry didn't want to jeopardize his chance for an acquittal by telling the truth prior to trial. Since the government case hinged on a weak eyewitness, Perry thought, hey, both he and Fennell had a decent chance of winning at their joint trial if he just kept his mouth shut. Basically, he gambled with his co-worker's life, withholding Fennell's trump card until he'd lost his own hand in court. Perry had much more to lose by coming clean at this stage. He hadn't been sentenced yet, and his admission of guilt here could basically destroy his prospects for a shorter prison sentence, let alone any shot on appeal. Although aware that he was sinking himself, Perry executed an affidavit and agreed to testify down the line. Perry had indeed sunk himself. With the affidavit on file, the judge gave Perry the max, 25 years to life behind bars. Meanwhile, Bobby Fennell's fate hung in the balance. He filed a motion under a New York law that allows a defendant to ask the trial judge for a new trial when fresh evidence emerges during the brief interlude between the verdict and the date of sentencing. At a hearing on that motion, Perry reiterated that he alone had shot Williams and that Fennell had not even been on the premises. The defense even put forward a couple eyewitnesses who corroborated that account. Despite this compelling evidence of innocence, the court denied Fennell's motion without any explanation. Another court affirmed the conviction on appeal. That appellate decision effectively served as the last word on the case for more than a decade. In the year 2000, Fennell's trial attorney sought assistance from a legendary defense lawyer, Will Hellerstein. Will was a tenured professor at Brooklyn Law School, while I was a young instructor on a short-term contract at the school. We had teamed up to form an entity known as the Second Look Program, a clinic where we worked with our students to investigate and litigate innocence claims by New York inmates. The timing of his lawyer's approach to Second Look was perfect. We needed cases to fuel our new venture, Fennell needed help, and his advocate's heartfelt pitch impressed us. We reinvestigated the case, conducting interviews with the defense attorneys involved in the trial and with Fennell's former girlfriend, who verified that she had been with him at the time of the murder. Fennell even passed a polygraph test, popularly known as a lie detector. Our efforts to find any of the purported witnesses to the crime didn't pan out. Still, our investigation confirmed the thrust of the post-trial hearing. Fennell was flat out innocent. Yet we needed a novel legal hook, something that could allow us to get back into court, strong newly discovered evidence that would absolve Fennell. Now, the phrase newly discovered doesn't just mean new to us or to our client. It means evidence that couldn't have been discovered by Fennell or his lawyer at the time of the trial and the initial post-trial hearing. No hook existed. The polygraph was of limited value in a courtroom. Perry had already testified, and the girlfriend's statements didn't comprise new evidence because she'd been available to testify back then. So there I was, in a prison visiting room in 2001, going through a mental checklist of the barriers that blocked the path to Bobby Fennell's exoneration. He walked in. I dispensed with the pleasantries and cut to the chase. I told him we wouldn't be taking his case to court, and that I was sorry. He sat there for a moment, stoic. I asked, "Is there anything I can do to make your life inside prison better?" I'll never forget his response. "It's not so bad," he said. "I have 3 hots and a cot. Thanks for trying." Bobby Fennell was an innocent man trapped in a cage with no clear way out. Yet, so accustomed was he to disappointment, so unfazed by my report, that he took pains to put a positive spin on his predicament to make me feel better about failing him. How is it possible that a prisoner with such a credible innocence claim could have no recourse? Bard answers that question and offers a path to a brighter future, one where accuracy is exalted above the systemic goals of finality and efficiency. Big idea number one, the trial is a vanishing species. There are just enough high-profile criminal trials to give the impression that heated courtroom battles over guilt or innocence are the norm. Think O.J. Simpson, Jahar Tsarnaev, Derek Chauvin. In truth, the criminal trial is a vanishing species, a casualty of the steady rise of plea bargaining. It makes sense why plea bargaining has displaced the American trial as the main mechanism for resolving criminal charges. Guilty pleas streamline the litigation process and suit the needs of prosecutors obsessed with conviction rates, overworked defense attorneys, risk-averse defendants, and neglectful judges tasked with managing jam-packed dockets. Defense lawyers and prosecutors tend to negotiate guilty pleas quickly, lives and liberty bartered away by harried attorneys speaking in hushed tones. Prosecutors often require that to get the benefit of a plea bargain, defendants must not only forsake their right to trial, but also waive their right to challenge any underlying issues in their case later on in an appellate tribunal. The defendant then appears in court to ratify the deal. At that hearing, known as a plea colloquy, the defendant admits guilt, testifies about the facts of the crime, and claims he knows what he's doing in entering the agreement and giving up his rights. A judge accepts the guilty plea and imposes the negotiated sentence, typically a fraction of the maximum sentence facing the defendant if the case had gone to trial. Justice signed, sealed, and delivered in a matter of minutes. The upshot here? Approximately 95% of criminal cases are resolved through plea bargaining, a percentage that's gone up since the tough-on-crime era of the 1980s. But the purported advantages of plea bargains wither on closer examination, especially for the innocent. Prosecutors, not judges, dictate the outcomes of cases by crafting plea offers on their own that effectively determine defendants' fates. Also, defendants aren't privy to all of the evidence in the prosecutor's files, and therefore are poorly positioned to weigh the pros and cons of going to trial. And if they make a bad decision and plead guilty, it's incredibly hard to overturn that decision down the line. Some states even make clear that a claim of actual innocence is not an adequate basis for toppling a plea bargain. This state of affairs creates a terrible quandary for defendants. Take the deal, sacrifice your right to trial, or roll the die and potentially receive a much stiffer punishment. What's gained here is efficiency and finality. What's lost is a public reckoning and a thorough accounting of the facts in an open forum. And what's unknown is whether the defendant is actually guilty. Big idea number two. The appeal is not a good vehicle for exposing innocence. Say an innocent suspect is charged with a crime, refuses to plead guilty, and goes to trial. Assume these hopes are naive. The jury returns a guilty verdict. It takes a lot to reverse a case after a defendant has lost at trial and exercise the right to challenge the conviction in a higher court, a process known as the direct appeal. Although every state grants this right, the direct appeal lacks the stature of the trial within the litigation hierarchy. As the Supreme Court observed in a 2017 case, quote, "The criminal trial enjoys a pride of place in our criminal justice system in a way that an appeal from the trial does not. The Constitution twice guarantees the right to a criminal trial, but does not guarantee the right to an appeal at all. The trial is the main event at which a defendant's rights are to be determined," end quote. The fact that the appeal is viewed as the undercard to the system's main event, the trial, is manifested in the rules that govern the appellate process. For instance, the defendant is confined to the trial record in raising claims on appeal. Even then, not every potential claim is recognized on appeal, only those that are what's known as preserved. A claim is preserved and eligible for a close look on appeal if the defense lawyer raised it with the trial judge and discussed it thoroughly. Now, there are two main rationales for the preservation requirement. The first is efficiency. We want legal issues vetted and resolved at trial. The preservation doctrine incentivizes lawyers to lay their cards on the trial table, maximizing the likelihood justice will be served in that phase. If you object, maybe the judge will agree, and there will be no need to appeal it at all. Or maybe the judge will overrule the objection, set forth the grounds for her decision, and leave a trail of breadcrumbs for the appeals court to follow in evaluating it. Second, there's the need to deter what some people call sandbagging, the purposeful withholding of a legal argument at trial in order to save it for a potential appeal. Suppose a lawyer is worried about objecting too much and coming across as, well, objectionable to the jury. Without the preservation requirement, she might hold back on an objection, keeping her views secret. If things go sideways and her client is convicted, the defendant could still try to argue the issue for the first time on appeal. That kind of gamesmanship is simply inconsistent with fair play. The downside of preservation, though, is that it makes appellate lawyers dependent on the skills and tactical decisions of the defense attorney who handled the case originally. Preservation also constrains the ability of appeals judges to aid an innocent prisoner. Big idea number three. Other post-conviction remedies aren't much better. Losing the direct appeal is not the end of the road for the innocent prisoner. There are also so-called collateral or post-conviction remedies that attack a case indirectly with new arguments or new evidence rather than launching a targeted challenge to exactly what happened in the trial court, which is the function of the direct appeal. One of these post-conviction remedies is known as the writ of habeas corpus, an ancient option that we borrowed from England. A habeas corpus filing asks the government officials to justify why they, quote, have the body, end quote, in custody. If no sound reason surfaces, the court may issue a writ, which is an order to release that person. The problem here is that courts have normally treated habeas corpus as a vehicle to correct constitutional or jurisdictional mistakes, not to address claims of actual innocence. Indeed, the Supreme Court has even indicated that a bare or freestanding innocence claim, an innocence claim standing all by itself in a case, is not even enough to get habeas corpus review. A second post-conviction remedy, which also derives from an ancient British writ, this one known as quorum nobis, is theoretically designed to grapple with fact-based questions of innocence. But all too often, quorum nobis fails to realize its potential. Quorum nobis translates to before us. It allows a prisoner to go back to the original trial judge, put forth new evidence that undermines confidence in the conviction, and ask for a new trial. But as we saw in the Bobby Fennell case from New York, quorum nobis doesn't always live up to its promise. Stingy visions about what comprises new evidence and how much new evidence is required to warrant a new trial make it less valuable than one might think when it comes to proving innocence. On that note, the entire litigation process itself may be less valuable than other processes in seeking to overturn a wrongful conviction. Big idea number four, parole and clemency are ill-fitting suits for the innocent. Now, if courts truly cared about innocence, the procedures governing these claims wouldn't be so burdensome. Full and fair airings of new evidence would happen more often, exonerations granted more readily, and faith in our criminal justice system restored more broadly. Yet the courts don't play the only role in righting wrongs. The executive branch also has opportunities to look at possible wrongful convictions through the tools of parole and clemency. Prisoners released on parole remained under state supervision, albeit outside their cells, for the rest of their sentence. Clemency, in turn, covers a range of things, most notably a pardon, in which a government official forgives the offense and wipes an inmate's slate clean, or a sentence commutation, which is when the government shortens or commutes a prison sentence. These executive remedies, however, are poor mechanisms for reversing wrongful convictions for reasons that are somewhat different from the ones that plague the courts. Parole and clemency, at bottom, are all about extending mercy, offering forgiveness to a prisoner who deserves a break. As a result, parole and clemency boards tend to seek an admission of guilt and acceptance of responsibility as a prerequisite for receiving mercy. This puts prisoners in a bind, or what I've labeled the innocent prisoner's dilemma. Option A, feign guilt to increase the chance of parole or clemency, while harming the chance for exoneration in court by creating an inculpatory statement on the record. Option B, stick to your guns, maintain innocence, and in the process, basically doom your prospects for freedom in the near term. Both of these options, parole and clemency, are suboptimal for the innocent, and outcomes reflect this reality. Big idea number five, a new model for evaluating innocence claims. As you know by now, existing judicial and executive branch remedies are not up to the task of freeing the innocent. Even when faced with powerful evidence that the system has made an egregious mistake. Now, we could tinker around the edges of these procedures to boost the odds of achieving justice. We could also consider more dramatic changes, ones that are in use in the United Kingdom and in a single American state, North Carolina. We could create innocence commissions in every state, independent agencies with the power and funding to investigate claims of actual innocence and refer the most meritorious of those claims to judges. Under this model, prisoners apply to the commissions for help. Investigators then take a deep dive into the cases. If the innocence claim seems valid after an exhaustive evaluation, then the cases would be sent up to the judges. With the imprimatur of the commission's approval, those judges would presumably take these cases very seriously. Now, to be sure, this is not a cure to our criminal justice system's many ills. Innocent prisoners would invariably slip through the cracks of an innocence commission process. And it's possible that courts might overvalue commission decisions to the point where these entities would effectively become both judge and jury, and with little to no accountability at that. Still, I have hope. By generating nonpartisan specialists in the area of actual innocence and giving them money to investigate these cases, we could better separate strong claims of innocence from the weak ones, and given the current failings of the criminal justice system to sort the innocent from the guilty, that strikes me as a big idea that is well worth considering.
Thank you, Daniel. That was Daniel Medwed with five big ideas from Barred, Why the Innocent Can't Get Out of Prison. For more ideas, listen to our book bite for Broken, How Our Social Systems Are Failing Us and How We Can Fix Them by Paul LeBlanc. I'm Michael Kovnat. Thanks for listening.